The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by six local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. You are listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis, and we have the Best of the Book Nook coming up. And today, a very special program, a tribute program. One of my guests from over the years, who's been on the show half a dozen times, died on May 31st. His name is Gene Logsdon, and I went back through the archives and pulled out some interviews from Gene's many conversations over the years, and we're going to bring you some of those coming up as we remember Gene Logsdon on the Best of the Book Nook. Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and today it truly is the Best of the Book Nook because we're featuring some interview excerpts from one of my favorite guests over the years, a man named Gene Logsdon. Gene died on May 31st. He was on the program half a dozen times over the years, and the first time I interviewed him back in 1998, I realized right away that this man was warm, witty, and he possessed a hard-earned wisdom. We're going to revisit that first interview with Gene Logsdon as we pay tribute to a wonderful man from Upper Sandusky, Ohio. His first book that I had him on for, he wrote many, is a book called You Can Go Home Again, Adventures of a Contrary Life. Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. And joining me by telephone from his farm near Upper Sandusky, Ohio, Gene Logsdon. He's the author of 16 books, and his current one is called You Can Go Home Again, and it's published by the Indiana University Press. Welcome to the program, Gene.
Well, hello. Glad to be on with you, Vic.
Now, there's a subtitle here, Adventures of a Contrary Life. And after reading your book, I have a clear understanding of what you mean by that. Why don't you give our listeners a little explanation of just how contrary you are?
Well, the best way to put it real briefly is my friends, the people who know me real well, when they saw the book that preceded this called The Contrary Farmer, they said, "Got that right, Gene." And by being contrary, I guess, what happened was that in my early life, I was very uncontrary. I really tried to do what elders and what people whom I thought were wise thought I should do. And they steered me into ways of life that I realized by the time I was 30 years old that were really not meant for me. So then I had this really grave problem of getting back to the kind of life I wanted to leave without starving to death. And so that made me pretty contrary, because what I found out that all the maxims, well, not so much the maxims, but all the models that were held up to me as successful people were not things that made me happy and were not necessarily successful, even if they made a lot of money. So in being contrary, I guess the first way that applies to me is that I've never really been interested in making money. Sounds heretical in modern materialistic America. But not being interested in making money, I never really tried too hard to make money. And whereas I thought that meant that was a sign of a lazy person, I soon found out that was a sign of greatest challenge, how to live, you know, fairly comfortably on a small amount of money. And to do that, you really had to sort of question everything that's held up to us as the good old American way.
Well, Gene, I've noticed in my brief existence here that a lot of times the people that are so bent on accumulating the most money seem to be the most unhappy.
Yes, I think that is generally the case. I always, you know, since I have so many friends who do have a lot of money, I'm always hesitant, especially in public, you know, to get too pompous on the subject. But it does seem true that people who make their life's goal just to see how rich they can become, in my experience, in experience of watching them, they are not happy. Or what happens also, and it seems it's kind of a mysterious thing to me, bad things happen to them. Not that bad things don't happen to all of us, but I just see people that my heart goes out to them, because just at the point where they have really got the world, you know, in their grasp, and maybe starting on their third or fourth million, there'll be some family tragedy happen that more often, I swear, than in less ambitious people. And of course, saying that, I immediately think, oh my God, I'm saying that God's punishing those people. And I really don't believe that either at all. You know, it is possibly just one of those things that can't be explained. I don't know. But then I also know people who have become fairly wealthy who do not exhibit any of the signs of greediness or overambition that we associate with that. There's a book out now, The Millionaire Next Door, I think it's called. And because we've been in a period of so-called great financial upswing in this country, you know, stock market and
grain prices.
Well, they're going down.
I'm just kidding, Gene.
No. These people have lived very modestly all their life. See, this to me probably is really the final argument in favor of contrariness. I'm thinking particularly of a few farm families I know who've done everything almost opposite of what the farm magazine said you had to do to become successful. And they're now, you know, one I know in particular, they have like $800,000 in the bank, and they live in a very modest house. They've always lived extremely modestly. And so there is that kind of wealth that comes from being contrary, you know. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I haven't made that one work either.
My guest is Gene Logsdon. His latest book is You Can Go Home Again, published by the Indiana University Press. This book is very autobiographical. In fact, I guess that's what I would describe it as. Also have a lot of messages that you're sharing here, and these were hard-learned messages in many cases. You almost became a priest.
Yes, uh-huh. Very close. You know, having written that book, and if I'm talking to somebody who has read it, and I know they've read it, you know, I feel like I'm naked. I've revealed a lot about myself, I don't know if this is a universal thing among people who have failed at things like, any way of life, but especially if you've gone and started to study to be a clergyman, to be a minister, to be a priest, and you found out that you really don't belong there, you become a little bit shame-faced about having even tried in the same way that I imagine that a person who was a bank robber in their early years and straightened out are ashamed of their early life. So, it was difficult for me to even bring that up, because I knew it would put in the minds of people who have a very unreal sense of what it means to be a seminarian in a monastery or in a seminary. If you say, well, I studied to be a priest, well, immediately they have an idea of what you're really like, you know, probably a little bit effeminate, you know, a little bit sissified, a little bit, I can't think of the word I want to use, but a person who would not care anything about manual labor or not care anything about hard work or not care anything about having a family. And, of course, that's all wrong, you know. And, of course, I guess I had to go to the seminary to find that out, because what I learned in the seminary was how much I love farming.
That was Gene Logsdon from the Best of the Book Nook. Our first interview together, recorded back in December of 1998 for his book, You Can Go Home Again, Adventures of a Contrary Life. I'm paying tribute to Gene on the program today. He died on May 31st, and he was one of my favorite guests over the years. He always made me laugh, and he always taught me something. Coming up in the next segment, we're going to revisit an interview with Gene that I did back in 2000 for his book, Good Spirits, A New Look at Old Demon Alcohol. Now this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and today I'm bringing you excerpts from interviews that I did with Gene Logsdon over the years. Gene died on May 31st. He was one of my favorite guests over the many programs that we did together. He always made me laugh, and he always taught me something. And in this interview we're going to feature next, we talked about his book that came out in 2000 called Good Spirits, A New Look at Old Demon Alcohol, in which Gene tells us about a bootlegger from his family and some drunken cows. From the Best of the Book Nook, here's Gene Logsdon. Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. And joining us by telephone from Upper Sandusky, Ohio, one of my favorite writers, Gene Logsdon. How you doing, Gene?
Well, hi. How are you? And you're one of my favorite interviewers. We might as well be really nice to each other starting out here. How many times when you introduce a writer do you say one of my favorite writers?
You know, I've never said that before, Gene.
No, I'm just kidding.
No, but we now call to order the Mutual Admiration Society.
Yeah.
Gene, you've got a new book out called Good Spirits, A New Look at Old Demon Alcohol. You've also got a book that's been reprinted in an expanded edition called Wildlife in the Garden. I'd like to talk about booze first, Gene.
Hey, that's much better than wildlife and booze maybe go right hand in hand if you interpret wildlife in the right way. Okay, let's talk about booze.
Okay, Gene, before we talk about booze, though, I want to talk about you. I want to tell our listeners, some of them probably didn't hear you the last time you were on when you were kind of like telling us your life story. Tell us your life story and do it in like 30 seconds.
Well, I've been connected with farming and writing all my life. That's probably the way I always wanted to be a farmer and a writer. You know, I was born and raised on a farm and back living on a farm, and actually have lived on farms or on a place in the suburbs that had 2 acres, in which I rapidly turned into a little farm, all my life. And all my life, I always also wanted to be a writer. And I guess the way to sum that up is that I chose as my two careers the two worst ways in the world to make a living. There's just not any money in being an independent writer or a small scale farmer. You know, if you get on a magazine staff, if I had stayed on a magazine staff today, I could retire, I guess, with a fair amount of security, whereas there's no way I can retire as an independent writer. You know, I just got to, like the corn farmer who keeps on producing more and more corn, the cheaper the price gets. Well, that's the independent writer, too.
Uh-huh. Are you saying that your writing is corny?
Some of it is, I'm afraid. I've been told that my writing had no angst by a very, very fervid young writer. Mr. Logsdon, I like your books, but you have no angst. And I said, what's that? But then I wrote a book and I sent it to her, and I said, now what do you think? And she wrote back and said, well, there's plenty of angst in this one. So I redeemed myself.
Now, which book was that?
That was You Can Go Home Again, you know, that about last year.
That's not full of angst.
Not really. It's, I am... I insist that, you know, there's no future in talking about nihilism. There's no future in talking about things gone to hell, even if you think they are, which I do. You know, you might as well take the high road, and people want to read, I think, want something hopeful, you know. Once you point out all the, or some of the, you can't ever point out all the problems in the world, but once you point some out, then I think the writer is almost duty-bound to try to show a way out of it, you know. And if you, I do it to an extreme, I'm afraid, because there's, I notice on the internet now, on that one website, what is it, the big one, Amazon.com, you know, where they allow readers to just write their own little interviews about any book that they read, you know, that they got from Amazon.
Uh-huh.
Wonderful idea. But I've really been taken to task here lately by a reader who says that I paint a world that's impossible to exist, you know.
That's on Amazon.com?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Oh, you must...
the writer is allowed to answer, and I had a notion to, but then I thought, well, everybody should have their say-so, you know. But when I show it, well, actually, it was my son who found it on the Internet, because I don't even mess with it. But, my family had a pretty good life of this, because what I wrote in that book is how we live. And if we are lucky enough to have a good life and a good time, you know, I'm going to say so. I don't care. I don't have any angst.
You must be so proud to be on a website having people complaining about you.
Oh, I have grave fears about the end of all this internet stuff. Although, I think it's good that people can do that. I just wonder what's going to be the... I'm sure you must have fears about... See, what I think is that these are the good years of the internet, when there aren't very many laws and almost anybody can write almost anything, you know, and put it on a website. And I'm sure that power mongering being what power mongering always turns out to be, they'll stop a lot of that. And some of it for good, of course. But I don't know, you know. I think it's great right now that we have a place where the whole world can get on there and say any fool thing they want to say, and they do. Do you follow the internet by any chance, or do any reading off of it yourself?
Despite what Al Gore says, I invented the internet, Gene. just kidding. Gene, you know, you mentioned how this is the glory time of the internet. You can do anything you want on there, and it makes me think, you know, that's really comparable to the good old days in this country, say 200 or 300 years ago, when you could make your moonshine and it wasn't against the law. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, let's talk about that. You finally found a way to get this thing back on track. Well, you know, that's really very, very true. I think the most interesting to say historically is that when the distillation of alcohol was discovered, you know, whoever did it, you know, they usually blame the monks on that, but it was actually goes way back earlier than that. People thought of liquor, if we can use that term, alcohol, drinking alcohol, as something divinely brought about. They did not see it what society does today as any kind of a danger, but a great uplifting sort of fluid that made you think of things you might not ever have thought of before to the good, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was not until, well, mostly in all wars, as far back in history as I've gone, and that isn't all the way, of course, but tyrants and kings and power mongers have tried to control the liquor because they realized that no matter what people said about it, one way or another, people were going to have it. You know, and I say that in the book over and over again. People were going to drink alcohol no matter what, and so they could tax the living heck out of it and get away with it. And so they did. In Russia, we think, you know, that state-owned stuff came about more or less with communism, but actually the they didn't call them kings. What did they call them?
Czars.
Czars.
Mm-hmm.
In Russia, they try to control many things, and especially the liquor industry from very early on, and made the making of vodka a state-owned business, same way whiskey is in this country. And right next door in Poland, where you had a much more, I better not say that. I was going to say a more intellectual type of person, but that's not very politically correct. But at least you had a different philosophy. And there the king, and I can't remember what his name was, but he said, hey, everybody can make vodka, you know, and opened it wide up. And as a result, for, you know, well, literally for centuries there, Poland, farming upon which the whole, you know, spirits distillation business rest, really, enjoyed prosperity. And all these little vodka makers enjoyed prosperity. And there were hundreds of them. Whereas in Russia, you know, it came down to a very almost, well, economically torn business between the government and the private vodka makers. And, you know, just the difference of black and white, you might say. And, of course, I use that in my book to show. And the purpose or the point of my book is to say that the distillation of liquors, I don't like to use that word because it already has such a bad connotation.
Yeah, behave yourself.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But I lost my train of thought. Whenever it was allowed to go its own way, you know, free of government restraint and without too many taxes, it worked to the economic benefit of just about everybody, and people did not fall into drunkenness any more than they did at any other time of history. And in our own history, you can see it so well, because when Jefferson got to be president, he's the one that really freed up the liquor business and said, hey, anybody can have their own still in their own house. And he was just being practical, because everybody did anyway out on the frontier. Washington and Hamilton had tried to quash the industry by taxing it to death. And so from the time of Jefferson on to the Civil War, when again spirits became subject for heavy taxation, it's often considered one of our brightest eras of history. You know, there was no decadence into drunkenness as certain types of people since then, you know, would have you believe. It just that a certain number of people, and it's, I've got the percentages in the book, but I don't remember them, maybe 10%, 12% will become alcoholic. Another 10, 12% will drink too much. But about 80% of the people just can handle their liquor very well. And it seems to me, and well, my argument in the book is that you're not going to stop this drunkenness. You know, we've tried every which way, you know, to keep people that are drunk off the road, and I think we're having a little success at it. But it seems to me that if we would adopt a more positive outlook about drinking, we might actually, we're not going to do any worse than we've done, you know, in quelling drunkenness, and we might actually make it better, because so much of drinking stems from a guilt feeling that we've put in people. You know, and take, you know, like, am I blabbing along too much?
No, Gene, you're fine. But I think the point you're getting to is people have developed this philosophy where drinking is bad, so they compartmentalize their drinking, and they have binge drinking, and
yes,
they drink heavily on the weekends. And
exactly. And if you know people, well, you know, beer makers, beer brewers, and wine makers who do their own at home, rarely, if ever, are they alcoholic, and never binge drinkers, because they can just go down the cellar and have a little drink at any time. And so they're relieved of that pressure, you know, that you see especially among younger people, and especially in college, to go out and have a blast on the weekend, you know. And so by the very nature, I think, of a healthier attitude, letting everybody produce the stuff that wants to, you know, who wants to, that you're going to actually lessen the amount of drunkenness rather than increase it. Anyway, that's my argument. And then I have the other economic argument, in that, you know, Appalachia today is a place where we have to just pour tax money into, welfare money into, and it, if you go back, you know, there's other reasons, of course, too. But one of the main reasons Appalachia has become centers of so-called poverty is because they're not allowed to make whiskey like they always did, you know, in the beginnings. And that if government would allow them, and I say, you know, get a system much like dairymen producing milk, and somebody comes along, picks it all up, you know, and takes it into central headquarters and processes it, that if we'd done that with whiskey makers, that Appalachia today would be a land of prosperity instead of a land of poverty.
We've been joined by the very spirited, opinionated person, Gene Logsdon. His new book, which just came out on a very nice little press out of, is it Vermont?
Yes, Chelsea Green.
Chelsea Green. It's quite a book. It's called Good Spirits, and Gene covers a lot of ground here. And I'd like to talk about your father-in-law, if you could.
I'd love to. He's one of my favorite people. Passed away now, but yes.
Tell us about him.
Well, he was a moonshiner. In a very, very proper family. And when I was first, you know, first dating, courting my wife, and we were running around together, and I practically lived at their house because I was in college, and the only place I could get anything decent, I didn't have any money, the only place I could get anything decent to eat was at their house, and her mother was a wonderful cook. And so I got to know him, and it was like married 5 years before I got this inkling of the fact that Daddy was a moonshiner. You know, they were all kind of ashamed of it.
Now, this is in Kentucky?
In Kentucky.
Okay.
Yeah, right outside of Louisville. And so, of course, I'd always been interested. Even when I was in college down there, I'd written a letter to the governor, requesting that he allow moonshiners to make and sell their whiskey like dairymen did milk. You know, of course, I never got an answer. He probably thought I was some really weirdo. But anyway, I'd already sort of formed an opinion about all this, especially since I had had some really good moonshine one time earlier. But anyway, so Granddaddy, as we called him, it turns out, you know, he had made moonshine, told me he paid for his farm that way, and never got caught, but came awful close to it. And of course, he was full of stories about moonshining that just fascinated me, and we'd sit around and he'd tell me about it. But it was a long time before the rest of the family was comfortable with Granddaddy telling me all these stories, because, of course, they knew I was going to write them all down. But eventually, I think, especially Carol, my wife's brothers, especially the two oldest ones who had witnessed, actually, well, had found the still in the barn, and their father had stood them up against the barn wall, you know, and made them swear they'd never say anything about it. And they were just little kids, you know, they didn't see anything wrong with it. So now, but then they started talking about it, and then after Granddaddy passed away, everybody felt, I guess, more freer to talk about it. And so I got all these stories that I put in the book about how their cows came home one night drunk. You ever see a drunken cow?
No.
Well, they act just like a drunken human being, and Granddaddy had the still back hidden, you know, above a what they call a sinkhole in Kentucky, you know, and that's kind of a hole in the ground, and you can pour water in it all day, and it, you know, it runs on down and goes out to someplace, you know, you don't necessarily know where it's going to come out.
Uh-huh.
So he had the still, and he was, like, pouring the leftovers or whatever, you know, down this sinkhole, and they were going on down and coming out in the creek.
You know,
about 200. Well, the cows found that, and cows love, you know, whiskey slop. As they just love it. And so they came home one night all wobbling, and Granddaddy was, he thought they had some strange and awful disease. They were all drunk.
Oh, my.
That was Gene Logsdon from the Best of the Book Nook, recorded back in February of 2000 as we talked about his book, Good Spirits, A New Look at Old Demon Alcohol. And can't you just picture those drunken cows that Gene was describing? He wasn't there, but it was all part of family lore, and what a storyteller he was. He died on May 31st. I'll miss him tremendously, but fortunately, we have many books that he wrote to enjoy and to learn from, and a lot of interviews that he did over the years. We can hear that voice. We can hear that wonderful laugh, and just an amazing man. We'll continue with our tribute to Gene Logsdon right after this. This is the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. And the program today has been a tribute to Gene Logsdon, who died on May 31st. The last time I had Gene on the program was in January 2014. He had just published a book called Gene Everlasting, A Contrary Farmer's Thoughts on Living Forever. And during this interview, we talked about death and mortality and a lot of other things. And this is our final segment in our tribute to Gene Logsdon this morning. I hope you enjoy it. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Gene Logsdon. He is my favorite living Ohio writer. Welcome back, Gene.
Well, thank you very much. You're making me nervous. You sure? I'm used to hearing people say, "Well, you know, I hear you." Sometimes I agree.
Well, Gene, I said that because, having read your new book, I thought, I sure am glad that Gene is still around for me to call up and talk to.
So am I.
Your new book is Gene Everlasting, A Contrary Farmer's Thoughts on Living Forever. And you wrote this because you had a health scare here in the last couple of years.
Yes, I did. When you're young, and for me that was forever, you know, I just thought, well, there's no such thing as dying. You know, that happened to other people. And I found out I had cancer. And so it was a bit nervy, you know, a bit scary time, yes. But it's in recession now, and so let's just think about it that way.
You live on a farm, and you're still active with the pastoral life, but you've also been writing for a long time. And in this new book, you make the observation that as a writer, quote, dying is the best story we will ever cover.
Yes, well, that's true. But as I go on to say there, practice makes perfect, so the more you know a subject, the better you can write about it, but you don't have that chance with dying. you do it once.
This new book is a collection of reflections and meditations, essays on various things, and a lot of them tie into that thought of, well, we're not going to be here forever. And one thing that you reflect on that you would think it's going to always be there is a pasture, but you've realized over the years that pastures are kind of impermanent things, aren't they?
Yes, they are, much more than you grow up playing on a pasture, you know, and working on it, and you just think that's the way it's always been. And as I've learned and say in that chapter, they're really quite impermanent. They were, in this part of the country anyway, really woodlands in the beginning, and when we cut down all the trees, cleared the land, and then put sheep on it, and sheep were very common here for a century or so. They kept it permanent, quote and unquote, and so in the last 30 years since we moved back here, I've watched there's no longer very much livestock in our whole county, and hardly any out on grazing land. And also the type of permanent pastures, quote and unquote, that I'm used to, they're small river creek valleys, and it's not enough room and not practical to farm corn and soybeans, you know, with big machinery. It's not efficient or profitable. And so this little valley that I grew up in right next to me, well, my land is part of it, actually, it's growing back to thickets. And the thickets are already, the new trees are coming up in them. And in another century, it'll be forest again unless somebody comes along and cleans it out. So it was kind of a soul-searing realization to figure that how impermanent the most permanent thing in my life is, you know.
Gene, it's been a while since we had you on the program. Why don't you tell our listeners what part of Ohio you live in?
It's in Wyandotte County. It's about midway between Toledo and Columbus, and so you all know, right north of Marion, a little town of Upper Sandusky is my hometown, and it is fairly level, except in the creek valleys, and it is almost, the agriculture has gone almost entirely to large-scale industrial corn and soybeans, and a few big animal factories, I call them, but mostly it's typical, agriculturally speaking, it's typical Corn Belt country.
Gene Logsdon joins us. His new book is Gene Everlasting, A Contrary Farmer's Thoughts on Living Forever. I was looking at your blog, and I think our listeners would be intrigued by some of your blog entries. If you want to check out his blog, just put Gene Logsdon in your Google search, and one of the first things you'll get is Gene Logsdon blog. And I saw you were talking about this book coming out, and you said something along the lines of, if you can read this book without shedding a tear, I'll refund your money.
That's kind of a stupid thing to say, I suppose. Well, but I think I'll hang in with that, yeah.
Well, you got me. I shed a few tears, and one of the essays that really made me choke up was the one called Kill Deer Woman.
Uh-huh.
It's about your mother.
Yes. It's an old essay. It appeared first in Farm Journal magazine, oh, Lordy, many years ago. And one of the first things I wrote, to tell you the truth, and I still think it just fit perfectly into this book, and so it went in. It's about how she died, my mother died, accidentally falling out of the haymow at home. And she was only 58, so it was a real, real shock to the whole family. And most of us were, the children were all fairly young yet, so it was a very sad time.
Well, it's very powerful, and also you get a real sense of what you're getting at in this book by the ending, which I'm not going to give away. Another one that really got me was called Maybe God is a Pure Red Iris.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I love that essay.
Well, thank you. I'll give you a little background. You want a little background? I mean, you know, at that time I was working for Farm Journal on their editorial staff in Philadelphia. And we were living on the outskirts of that great big city, and never was very, very comfortable there. But we lived in an area that was very unusual in that it wasn't exactly a country, and it wasn't exactly suburban either. It was sort of in between. And the old man who lived across the road from us was a master gardener, and he sort of befriended me, to tell you the truth, and then I just started going over there all the time because even though I had been brought up on a farm, what I knew about farming was milking cows and running big tractors, and here was a man who had on just not even half an acre, about half an acre, no, three-quarters of an acre, now I'm remembering, had built a self-subsistent life that was just remarkable. He had chickens, he had rabbits, he had all the vegetables and fruit that he needed, and he also grew flowers and sold them. So he had it like his own little business there. And I was really affected by him because he was teaching me that you could have a real farm and real farm life on a very small acreage. And I knew, or I surely didn't think I would ever going to be able to afford more than a few acres. But, you know, even then I was planning on moving back to a farm. So anyway, I listened to him and watched him, and he taught me so many things. He taught me how to breed flowers. He was growing iris, and he was trying to grow one that was pure red. I don't think there are any pure red iris even today, but that was his goal as his, you know, his business along with his way of life there. And so as he grew weaker and weaker, we lived next to him for 9 years. And, you know, it was obvious that at some point he was going to have to retire and move to an old folks home, I suppose, as we called them, old folks home. You're not supposed to say that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we fell into conversation. He was thinking about death, and he'd ask me, you know, provocative questions about what I thought about death. And, of course, at the time, I didn't think anything about it because I was never going to die.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about raising or growing iris and he wanted to know, you know, what do you think about diet? And he asked me one day real abruptly, and of course, I had never, you know, really done any thinking about it. But as the conversation went on, it just seemed an appropriate place, and it popped into my mind without thinking, really. I said, he's talking about dying and what, you know, what happened. And I said, maybe God is a pure red iris.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, he caught on immediately, and he was, you know, he was not a talkative man at all, but he got this strange smile on his face, and he nodded, and you could tell that he thought that was a pretty, maybe that made his life there even more worthwhile. His search for red iris is really his search for God.
Mm. Yeah, you nailed it on that one. That was great to see you in that young incarnation where you hadn't thought about death, and now all these years later, you're looking back and you were feeling kind of weak from the chemotherapy that you got for your treatment. And in one of your essays, Garden Therapy Along with Chemotherapy, you were just strong enough to sit out there in the garden and do a little weeding in a chair. And you started looking around you, didn't you? You started noticing a lot of things like bugs that you hadn't really paid much attention to.
Yes. There's just so many details in a garden, in a yard, in a small woodland. You know, you could spend your whole life just studying the life that was there, you know. And in great detail, it becomes very dramatic. And so there I was, you know, I was too weak to stand up and hoe, really. And I'd be crawling around in this case, in the black raspberry patch, pulling the weeds out. And I just began to notice all the life there. And it was just remarkable. I had already, I'm sure in many things that I had written, you know, preached that line. But this was, I was actually living it and proving it to myself. And out of it came, you know, a discovery that I don't think, well, I'm sure the scientists know, but how many different bugs, insects, are pollinators? You know, I'm real deep into bees, you know, losing all our bees, and so we're losing all our pollination. And I found all these different kinds of bugs that were landing on the raspberry blossoms, and obviously they were pollinating because they'd go down in the blossom, you know. And so I got the insect book out, and just, you know, there were like I think about 15 different kinds of bugs that I couldn't even identify until I got the bug book out, that were actually pollinating. And so what they were saying in their silent little way was that, you know, it's not the end of the world if all our honeybees died off. I mean, it would be terrible, but it would not really stop nature. And then, of course, I realized that honeybees aren't even native to the United States. So
that's an amazing thing. I don't think most people in this debate about honeybees possibly going extinct realized that they weren't here before.
Right. Neither was bluegrass, one of our greatest plants.
Speaking of plants, I mean, you're looking at bugs, you're looking at birds, animals, you look at all this stuff around you, but you really look closely at plants. In fact, you've got a couple of essays about specific plants that have bedeviled you over the years. One of them's Intimations of Immortality, Chickweed, and the other one is Intimations of Immortality, Pigweed. I think most of our listeners probably don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about these particular plants.
Well, it's interesting. If they're gardeners, they think about them, I guarantee you, because they can be very pestiferous, and yet when you start studying them and their history, you know, they can be or really are very beneficial plants in their own way, in their own place. And so it's another case of where they're considered weeds, but they really, really have been lifesavers, you know, in different ways in different civilizations, especially pigweed, you know, amaranth. And this new kind of pigweed that's moving north now, and it's almost immune to all kinds of herbicides. Yeah, it just nothing kills it. In fact, it seems to grow better with a little squirt of all of a sudden, I can't think of the name of the common herbicide.
Roundup.
Uh-huh, thank you.
Yeah.
And so, amaranth, pigweed, was one of the major food sources for ancient man, you know, in the Mayan civilization and even in North American, the mound builder, woodland Indian civilization, they depended on pigweed like we depend on corn.
Huh. Wow. That's pretty amazing. The book is Gene Everlasting: A Contrary Farmer's Thoughts on Living Forever. Gene Longston joins us. And how old are you now, Gene? 82, is it?
82, yes.
Wow.
And that was the late Gene Longston talking about what I believe was his final book, Gene Everlasting, A Contrary Farmer's Thoughts on Living Forever. Gene died on May 31st, and he will be missed. I know I'll miss him. We had a half dozen interviews over the years, and I was going through my interview archives, and there were so many things to choose from. I had a hard time selecting the material for this tribute program this morning because I just had so many wonderful alternatives. And he wrote a lot of books over the years. He actually wrote some fiction. In fact, I interviewed him for one of his novels. And maybe we'll be able to put together another best of Gene Longston sometime in the near future. So I'm hoping that I can do that. I talked to him for his novel, The Last of the Husbandmen, back in the day. He wrote about everything. He had a book called Small-Scale Grain Raising. Also, The Contrary Farmer's Invitation to Gardening. The Pond Lovers, All Flesh is Grass, Living at Nature's Pace, The Contrary Farmer, The Low Maintenance House, Gene Longston's Practical Skills, Organic Orcharding, A Grove of Trees to Live in, Getting Food from Water, A Guide to Backyard Aquaculture, The Gardener's Guide to Better Soil, Successful Berry Growing, Homesteading, How to Find New Independence in the Land, and a very interesting book that he did, we had him on the program for it, called Wyeth People, A Portrait of Andrew Wyeth as Seen by His Friends and Neighbors. If you listened to the entire program this morning, you probably noted that during that first segment, recorded back in 1998, as we discussed his book, You Can Go Home Again, Adventures of a Contrary Life, Gene talked about the internet, and you could tell that it was something he really wasn't that familiar with at that point, 18 years ago. He asked me, do you go on the internet? He seemed curious about it, but he also seemed sort of determined not to get involved. Well, that changed. Gene became into the internet big time. In fact, he had a blog, and it's worth looking up because his blog posts are still out there. You can still read them, and they are brilliant. Just do a Google search for Gene Logsdon, GeneLogsdon, and check out his wisdom in his blog. And he blogged right up to the end. Gene died on May 31st. A lot of us are going to miss that man. For the best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis, and I really appreciate you tuning in. And if we can put together another tribute program to Gene, I'll do that, and I'll keep some of you posted out there. I know a lot of you are wondering about this program and the potential for another one. So we'll dig into our archive and see what we can put together for you. Thanks for tuning in. And Gene, wherever you are, we'll miss you. Good morning.